Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we have three great guests who are experts in Freedom Schools. Dr. John Hale is an associate professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and the author of the book, The Freedom Schools, Student Activists in the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. Dr. Hale, thank you for being on this month's podcast. So when did Freedom Schools emerge, and why did they emerge?
The Freedom Schools as we know them today, you know, they emerge in its recognizable form that we have today in the 1960s. And these were a product of the civil rights movement. They grew out of political protest and demonstrations against a segregated, racist school system. So Freedom Schools were set up in sort of these alternative spaces. In the state of Mississippi, we see Freedom Schools emerge as summer schools, essentially, for training young people to be activists, to challenge the oppressive legislation and policies and laws that were maintaining, you know, a de jure segregated society. They were training people to be, young people to be informed citizens who would take on the challenge of eradicating racism and oppressive policy. So they begin in the 1960s, but I'd also want to mention that, they come into fruition in the 1960s. The idea of a freedom school or schooling for freedom goes back to the era of enslavement. And a popular sort of text to look at is Frederick Douglass's Autobiography of a Slave, where he writes about the importance of literacy. And in that, Douglass points out that the pathway from slavery to freedom is in fact literacy and education. So that very principle that to be educated, to gain literacy, is a path toward liberation and freedom, is grounded during the era of enslavement and grounded in an act of resistance. And then after the Civil War, we have the establishment of the Freedmen's Bureau to establish, you know, courts, to establish, you know, literally military to oversee the voting processes. But one of the aspects is also establishing schools. These were known as freedmen's schools. And in some popular vernacular or nomenclature, we have freedom schools emerge. So the idea of schooling and freedom, and even that language, we really see since the 1860s. But it was a century later, during the Black Freedom Struggle of the 1960s, that we see people actually implement freedom schools. And much to the ideology of education for liberation and resistance, Freedom School wasn't held in a traditional school. They were held in church sanctuaries and church basements, private homes of activists who would take in children to teach the principles of freedom, right? So it's an act of resistance. We see it become more popular in the 1960s, but really to tell the history of the Freedom Schools is to tell the history of education and resistance and using education for liberation. So it's a very long history that we have behind Freedom Schools.
So you mentioned Mississippi. Were there other parts of the South where these schools emerged, or did they also emerge in the North, or do we know a lot about that?
The most comprehensive network emerges in Mississippi. There's 41 schools during the summer of 1964. It's a cogent sort of network of schools that are training over 2,000 students across the state to become activists. Like that's a largest network we have at this point in United States history. But we do see earlier iterations of that in Boston, New York, and Chicago in the early 1960s. And these freedom schools were generally formed when civil rights activists decided to boycott segregated schools. So in the larger northern cities like Chicago, they would have a Freedom Day, when they would stay out of the segregated, under-resourced public schools and hold Freedom School. So those actually are a predecessor to the Freedom Schools in 1964 in Mississippi. So we have actual Freedom Schools developing in the early 1960s, again, as a result of protests and demonstrations and articulations of freedom through education.
And in all these various places, who was teaching and who was attending these schools?
Yeah, so teachers varied. And I'll also say, too, about, in addition to these northern cities, we also have a network, and this was developed out of Highlander Folk School in close collaboration with Seta McClark, who's an activist, a scholar activist and scholar-teacher activist from South Carolina, developed citizenship schools. And these were training adults how to read and write in order to pass these discriminatory literacy tests. So citizenship schools sort of are conflated with freedom schools, you know, all around this idea of education for liberation and freedom. So who's teaching in these schools are oftentimes activists who are organizing the boycotts. So in Mississippi, we have a core of volunteers, about 1,000 strong, coming across from colleges and university campuses across the United States. The freedom schools of the 1960s, notably, often are not actual trained teachers. To be a trained teacher in the 1960s could be trained in the art of oppression, could be trained to sort of maintain the status quo. So these were not ideal teachers to a lot of activists. So activists themselves taught. It required an activist to see education as an oppressive institution, to come up with a curriculum that centers Black narratives and Black histories and histories of communities of color. So activists knew to do that. Activists were teaching the freedom schools. I will also say, in Mississippi, there were a lot of white activists who were teaching freedom schools. And that was quite problematic because we have a lot of unchecked racist assumptions that white activists, even though they were demonstrating the risk in their lives, they oftentimes weren't checking their own positionality. So they were largely white teachers, they were activists, but these were not perfect spaces by any means. But that's who was teaching the schools. And then young students who were attending freedom schools, young people who were cognizant of oppressive policy and racist policy, who wanted to challenge that, were attending freedom schools. Young people were making the intentional decision to enroll in a freedom school to become better activists, to change the very communities they were in. So it was very much an activist space.
So let me switch gears a little bit. I'm curious about the connection between freedom schools and leaders in Black America. Is there any evidence of the relationship between freedom schools and individuals who then went on to become leaders in the civil rights movement, for example, or part of the Black American intelligentsia?
Certainly. So it's interesting because in the spring, the winter of 1963 and the spring of 1964, there's a collection of activists who go to New York to write the Freedom School curriculum. And here you have Ella Baker, Miles Horton, Setha McClark, Bob Moses. I mean, the Black and allied intelligentsia of the movement are meeting in New York and they're asking the question, what should we teach in a Freedom School? And they come up with a curriculum that presages multiculturalism of the 1980s and 90s. And it's a curriculum. We call it culturally sustaining. It was based on a lot of critical questioning. A lot of students were encouraged to ask questions. It was very much diving into Black history and literature. So, yeah, we have as much as freedom schools represent an activist moment in time, a movement or a movement of activism, it's also an intellectual movement where we're redesigning a curriculum and we're asking these deep pedagogical questions about what should we teach and how in order to change an unjust society. So it's very much an intellectual movement at the same time. Something I'm always interested too is to look at this idea of education for resistance. It's not a it's uniquely African-American in the sense of how it develops with citizenship schools and freedom schools. But we have the American Indian Movement survivalist schools are part of this larger intellectual activist movement. We also have specific schools or notions of freedom around LGBTQ movement later about rewriting the curriculum for that. So really the freedom schools lends itself to other intersectional approaches to address oppression. It opens up a new way of sort of approaching education that you know, it really starts a larger movement to say, now we have freedom schools on reservations, we have freedom schools specifically LGBTQ, we have Latin freedom schools, right, where we look at the use of language, right, or language revitalization. So I mean, it's really lends itself well to intersectional coalitions.
Our second guest this month is Dr. Crystal Moore Clemens. Dr. Clemens is the National Director of Freedom School Programs for the Children's Defense Fund and the author of the article, I've Got to Do Something for My People, Black Women Teachers of the 1964 Mississippi Freedom Schools. Dr. Clemens, thank you for being on this month's podcast. So Dr. Clemens, so what do we know about what early freedom schools taught students, and if at all, how that varies from what students are taught in freedom schools today?
So the original freedom schools was really geared towards combating what Charlie Cobb talked about as sharecroppers education, meaning children were not engaged in quality public education in 1964 in Mississippi. And so a group of college age advocates, activists, caravan to first Miami University of Ohio to get civil rights and resistance training, then down to the various counties in Mississippi to teach children and families about voter registration, the democratic process, the political system. We also know from the literature and from speaking to the civil rights activists who were in Mississippi at that time, they also taught language arts. They taught African American history. They taught drama, theater, all of the things that Black children were not getting in their traditional public school setting is what the original freedom schools taught.
So is there any evidence of the impact of freedom schools on the lives of students, or is there any research on the impact of freedom schools on student well-beings and outcomes, or the outcomes of communities where freedom schools are located?
Absolutely. The research on the contemporary freedom schools is pretty vast, actually. We've seen research talking about the children involved in the local freedom schools programs. We've seen research about the teachers involved in the local freedom school program. It's ranging from their efficacy with the reading curriculum, all the way to social emotional learning, to teacher education, and to leadership development. The Children's Defense Fund, we actually have our own assessment instrument that we use. We're building off of the basic reading inventory. And so we've had studies done where we do a pre and a post at the beginning and end of our Freedom School summer enrichment program, where we are, you know, learning about a child's reading gains from the summer that they're engaged in the Freedom School program. So lots and lots of research being done. If you go to the childrensdefensefund.org and you see the Freedom Schools webpage, you'll have a tab on there that says impact. And we have a research in the field document, which is essentially an annotated bibliography of the studies that have been done on CDF Freedom Schools programs throughout probably the last decade or so.
So you mentioned the important role of pedagogy in freedom schools. Both historically and recently, we know that there's been a lot of news about pushback against K-12 schools teaching about race. Have you noticed any pushback against freedom schools and the curriculum of freedom schools, in particular as it relates to what freedom schools teach about race?
Yes, there have been challenges historically and in our current context, absolutely. I mean, if you think back to 64 and the original freedom schools curriculum that was full of art, culture, African-American history, again, the original Freedom Schools curriculum was supplementing what the children were not getting in their traditional public school context. The other thing is that it was also, and what Daniel Perlstein talks about, it was increasing scholars' capacity to make a demand. So it was a curriculum that really helped young scholars, whether you were in 64 or whether you're in 2022, realize that your vote matters, your voice matters, your lived experience matters. And we want to give you the tools and the language to express yourself, to really enhance the human condition. So the contemporary Freedom Schools curriculum, we don't shy away from talking about race. We look at our curriculum and we look at our trainings and our site libraries and our books really as a culturally responsive and a culturally sustaining opportunity for young scholars. So like right now we have text in our curriculum. We have the book on Sonia Sotomayor by Jonah Winter. We have The Voice of Freedom by Fannie Lou Hamer by Carol Boston Weatherford. We have her most recent text too on the Tulsa race riots. So we go all over with the curriculum. We have some text on Cesar Chavez. We have text on Kamala Harris. We have text on The Hidden Figures, Katherine Goebel, and the human computers out of NASA. So our text really provide breadth and depth of what it means to be an unsung hero or shero in American society. Mrs. Edelman always says you can't be what you can't see. And it's our job through the integrated reading curriculum is to curate a curriculum and text that allow children to see themselves.
So I asked John this question, but is there any connection between freedom schools and students or individuals involved in the civil rights movement or who grew up to take positions of leadership in movements for racial justice?
Oh, absolutely. I wrote my dissertation on Black women teachers from 1964. And all the women that I interviewed talked about how being an original teacher in the 64 Freedom Summer at those freedom schools really put them on a trajectory for lifelong learning and lifelong leadership. They went on to become, you know, community advocates, college professors, leaders. You know, if you think about it, Bob Moses was on the ground in Freedom Summer, and he created the Algebra Project. Then he went on to create all that wonderful work that came after. You look at Charlie Cobb, you look at Hollis Watkins. I mean, you look at leaders like Ella Baker, right? In terms of her definition of leadership, right? And I would say the same goes for a traditional Freedom School participant. And I can speak from my own lived experience. You know, 20 years ago, I was a servant leader intern in a local freedom school in Chicago. And if I did not have the opportunity to go get trained at Alex Haley Farm in Clinton, Tennessee, and really learn the freedom school curriculum and history, I don't know if I'd have a doctorate right now. And I definitely don't know if I'd be your national director of CDF Freedom Schools right now. And so there are countless stories like that, of how just the training alone and the history alone and the knowledge alone has really catapulted those who've participated in it for lifelong learning and, you know, key leadership roles. We have servant leaders right now who are serving in the California Assembly. You know, everywhere I go, I'll tell them what I do. Someone will say, oh, I was a Freedom School intern, but I was a Freedom School intern in the 90s. Oh, no, I did it in the early 2000s. I mean, it's the alumni network is vast, and the folks that are leading many of the critical work have been involved in the movement some way, somehow.
Our final guest this month is Dr. Kendall Dees. Dr. Dees is a postdoctoral fellow in the African American Studies program at the University of South Carolina. He is an expert in freedom schools and K-12 school finance and the author of the forthcoming article, Legal Implications of Race-Based School Funding Policies to Close Racial Achievement Gaps in Education. Dr. Dees, thank you for being on this month's podcast. Dr. Dees, let me start with asking you about freedom schools. So what do freedom schools do today?
Well, today freedom schools are really highly successful summer and after-school enrichment programs for children between the ages of 5 and 18. And freedom schools today are educational enrichment programs that really carry out the mission of Miriam Wright Edelman's Children's Defense Fund. And the mission of the Children's Defense Fund is to ensure basically that every child has a healthy start, a head start, a fair start, safe start, a moral start in life, with the support of caring families and communities. And the Children's Defense Fund works with Congress and the federal government to advocate for policies that improve children's lives, to put a focus on improving children's lives. And there's research that shows that Freedom Schools can be one of those viable policies to improve children's lives and really move the needle in terms of adequately addressing achievement gaps or existing education deficits. So today, Freedom Schools incorporate the totality of this Children's Defense Fund mission by fostering environments that support children and young adults. This is essentially what the Freedom Schools look like today. This is the essence of Freedom Schools today.
So do we know how many Freedom Schools there are in the United States and who these schools serve?
In the United States today, the Children's Defense Fund Freedom Schools national program operates over 130 summer program sites, and they're in 24 states across the country, and they serve a vast array of children. They serve nearly 12,000 children in the United States today. And they can operate out of university communities. So for example, in South Carolina, we have a CDF Freedom School that operates out of the state's flagship research university, where I'm based as a faculty member, the University of South Carolina. But they also, for example, can operate out of church congregations. So in Columbia, South Carolina, for example, there's a CDF Freedom School supported by a United Methodist Church, and it's Francis Burns United Methodist Church. Actually, I have family members who attend that church and actually support that school. So they're based in a variety of environments.
So what needs to happen from a policy perspective to support Freedom Schools today?
Yes, I would say the model itself does not need to change. It's a successful model, and research shows that CDF Freedom Schools have been successful at moving the needle in terms of reducing summer learning loss. And this proven success makes it an attractive policy model for states to adopt to address existing achievement gaps or education deficits. So I think one of the strategies will have to be pointing to that existing research showing that Freedom Schools as a potential model policy has proven success. It has a track record of proven success. So this could be used to encourage individuals in positions of power, policymakers, to consider it as a viable policy to address education challenges we're facing at state levels. I would say that what does need to change with the program is that program leadership at the various site levels need more support or assistance in terms of locating potential sources of funding for the programs. And so that has been a challenge, I think, that has occurred in various sites. I know in the Charleston site where I have experience serving on the board, it was a tremendous challenge generating funding for the program. And so I would think that there needs to be a viable strategy for locating funding for the schools, and then having national leadership assist leaders in the lower levels finding those potential sources. I would also say that one of these potential sources of funding could be large, well-established church communities. Providing children with access to a quality education concerns religious congregations. And because of this concern, they can see CDF Freedom Schools as a great investment. So I know in the case of Charleston, we began looking at large congregations in the city, and they expressed great interest in supporting the Freedom School program. And I know in Columbia, the example I used earlier with Francis Burns United Methodist Church, very heavily involved financially in supporting the existence of that particular program. I would also say in terms of schools that may be interested in pursuing similar goals to succeed, I would say that given the changing demographics in our country, and the browning of the nation's public schools due to white flight to suburbs, for example, public schools interested in pursuing similar goals associated with Freedom Schools would benefit from offering greater diversity in the curriculum, which would include books that reflect on the experiences of children of color. And that really serve the purpose of enhancing their self-esteem and providing them with empowerment. I really think that any school system in this country that would want to embrace the goals of the Freedom School would benefit from introducing diverse curriculum. So public schools in America interested in these goals related to Freedom Schools could benefit immensely by incorporating a similar curriculum and overall approach to education.
So are there any recommendations that any of you would like to give to listeners or anything that you'd like to highlight about Freedom Schools or the current Children's Defense Fund Freedom Schools program?
If there's anything else I'd like to highlight about the program, one thing would be is that it's an intergenerational leadership movement. And a lot of times when we talk about Freedom Schools, we talk about it within the K-12 context and how it enriches the children's lives who participate in the six-week summer program. But it also enriches the adults' lives, that the folks that have to get trained to teach in the program, which then becomes a workforce development opportunity. If you can work in a CDF Freedom School as a college-age servant leader intern and have that justice mindset and have that culturally responsive lens on things, you will be a better CEO. You will be a better lawyer. You will be a better pastor. The nature of the program allows you to have a more holistic approach to how you see the world. And so it's a true intergenerational leadership model. The other thing that I would add is that we are growing. We are building out our capacity now to serve more scholars nationwide. So if people are interested in bringing a local Freedom School to their local community, I encourage them to log on to our website and download a copy of our application. It's childrensdefense.org, Freedom Schools, and you will be able to see how to start a site. You'll be able to see what it needs in terms of funding and staffing. And so for anyone that's interested in growing and being part of a national movement, I encourage them to visit our website to learn more or reach out to us directly at the Children's Defense Fund.
Thank you, John, Crystal, and Kendall for being on this month's podcast. As always, thank you for listening, and we hope that you're safe and healthy. And remember, for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter or follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweets.